everybody, to this session of the Socialism Conference. Before we get started, we have solidarity greetings from China of what's happening in Hong Kong right now. So I'm going to read that statement. It's from Ong Long Yu, who's a Chinese Marxist. The storming of the legislature and its subsequent occupation constitutes another climax of the anti-China extradition law movement. Even if there were individual excessive acts by the occupiers, the occupation as a whole is the voice of the young generation who has been denied a fair voice in the society, a voice which has won the heart of more than half of the population. The Carrie Lam government and its Beijing backer are morally and politically bankrupt. People all over the world, people who are for democracy and equality, please come forward to express solidarity with Hong Kong freedom fighters. A protest outside the Beijing embassy or just a community gathering will be a blessing for us. So Dennis will be speaking for about 30 or 40 minutes. He's a socialist, longtime socialist in Chicago, has written a lot on the Tiananmen Square uprising. And with the 30-year anniversary, it's an important talk to be had. After that, we'll have discussion. Thank you.
I appreciate people coming to this. There's a lot of competition out there. I won't hang out with the kids taking down climate change, you know. But anyway, I was going to start actually with a recording. There's an interesting documentary you can get off of YouTube. It's like a two-part documentary about the Tiananmen Square uprising. But I just wanted to start off with, since I don't have an audio visual, I'm just going to do the audio. Get a sense of what it sounded like. My Mandarin's rusty, but for people who didn't understand, some of the chants at the end, they were chanting, oppose violence, guarantee human rights, patriotism is not a sin, brutality is shameful, we want free speech, abolish censorship, and then finally, Hu Yao Bang lives on. But the background music that it started with, people may be familiar with, is the Internationale, the Communist Internationale. It's a song worldwide. Oops. And I don't know if people are familiar with the lyrics, though. And I'm not talking about the Charles Kerr lyrics that I think most of us sing in English. Charles Kerr, great person, you know, vegetarian, Unitarian. Nothing against vegetarians or Unitarians, they're great. But if you actually translate the words of the Chinese Internationale, it's a little bit different flavor. So I'm gonna read it, you know, part of it. It says, "Arise, slaves afflicted by hunger and cold. Arise, suffering people all over the world. The blood which fills my chest has boiled over. We must struggle for truth. The old world shall be destroyed. Arise, slaves, arise. We do not say that we have nothing. We shall be masters of the world. There have never been any savior of the world, no deities, no emperors to which to depend to create mankind's happiness. We must entirely depend on ourselves. We shall retake the fruits of our labor and let the mind burst free from its prison cell. Let the flames in the furnace burn red hot, for only when the iron is hot, we will succeed in forging it." The last stanza is my personal favorite. Who has created this world of humankind? It is us, the masses. Everything is for the workers. How can the parasites be accommodated? The most detestable are those poisonous snakes and savage beasts, eating up our flesh and blood. Exterminate them all at once. The red sun will shine all over the globe. So, you know, exterminate them all at once. There's not really a debate in the nationality about revolutionary violence amongst the Chinese, apparently. Fair enough. But the contradiction you think about is just this song is being sung by students as they were marching through China. They were through Tiananmen. They sang it as they left Tiananmen. When it was vacated on the night of June 3rd and morning of June 4th. The cognitive dissonance between the actual words and what was happening are pretty incredible. The Internationale is the official anthem of the Chinese Communist Party, so the students singing it was calling to attention what this was about, what this struggle was about. An analogy it made me think of was during the early civil rights movement in this country, black people walking off the American flag saying, whose flag is this? What does this represent? So I think similarly you can say, what is the words? Do these words actually ring true? Is this country actually about its stated ideals? And this is the main contradiction of the Tiananmen Square uprising, which makes it so potentially confusing to understand. How does a so-called socialist country send the army, which is actually called the People's Liberation Army, into Tiananmen with rifles to clear its capital of protesting students and workers? Isn't the role of the army to liberate the people from colonial rule and not murder them? I'm not going to do a day-by-day, blow-by-blow account of what happened in the spring of 1989, because that's what Wikipedia is for. But I do want to draw out four main political lessons that I think are important and people should raise their own during the discussion. The first one is that the protest of Tiananmen was a result of the contradictions in both the Chinese political system and their changing economy. Number two, the government shut down the protest with violence because the working class became mobilized, and that was the true danger that crossed that Rubicon for them. Thirdly, it is important for the left to understand a method of evaluation for things such as Tiananmen, to understand it. And finally, that China has and will continue to see similar things happening like Tiananmen. So point number one, why did the protest happen? What were the conditions that caused it? It's a big question, it's gonna take a little time, so bear with me. This obviously is not a talk about modern Chinese history. I apologize to those in the room who I know are already deeply aware of it, maybe I'm sure more so than me. But context is very important to understand, so I'm gonna take some time with that. I'm only gonna cover 5% of Chinese history, written history, so that gives me about 150 years, I guess, so you can bear with me for that. So the first Opium War was where the British opened a market of selling drugs grown in neighboring India using gunboat diplomacy. Gunboat diplomacy, so people just are clear, is all gunboat, no diplomacy. Basically, you just take, you know, go up the river and say, we're going to sell you opium, and that's how it's going to be. And this kicked off what became known as 100 years of humiliation to the Chinese, where every imperial power with an army and boats basically set up shop along the coast of China. Maybe there would have been more powers coming in if airplanes had been invented. I just put that out there because there's some misconception being spread that airplanes existed prior to 1903. But anyway, that's fake news. Sorry to... Can't see you come away if this is not learning anything, right? So speaking of... there was a struggle there to get rid of the colonial powers, to get them out of China. And speaking of independence, there was, as Anne read the statement early, there was recently a protest in Hong Kong to mark the 22nd anniversary of Hong Kong's return to China, which resulted in, you know, obviously major protests. But it was Hong Kong's return to China from Britain in 1997. That's right. The British had a colony in China for 156 years, from 1841 to 1997. Queen Elizabeth, you know, God bless her holy soul, or whatever the saying is, appointed the last dozen governors of Hong Kong. That's how Hong Kong was run. And that explains why you look at, you know, shots of like Hong Kong courtrooms, they wear those weird curly horsehair wigs. It's like, well, that's it's because it was run by British. They all speak with British accents and they speak English. It's kind of strange. It would be impossible to calculate the total amount of wealth that the British sucked out of Hong Kong over the years. But in 1996, Hong Kong was the 28th largest economy with the GDP of $159 billion, just behind Greece and ahead of Saudi Arabia, which, as you know, just gets oil out of the ground. It's an impressive amount of money. Under China's watch, the GDP of Hong Kong has actually gone from under 61 billion in 2003 to 341 billion a year annual. And so I guess the commies are a little bit better at making money than the Brits were. But in any case, back to the Chinese history thing. The struggle for liberation of China from colonial powers took some decades to develop, but it eventually did. And this is not just true for China. Colonial occupation in general does bring about resistance. From India to Little Big Horn to Palestine, Vietnam, Angola, South Africa, Afghanistan to Iraq, wherever there's occupation, resistance will eventually form. Resistance doesn't always result in success, but we all know that without an attempt at resistance, there will absolutely be no success. And as socialists, I think we need to support self-determination and national liberation of all oppressed people when they do rise up against their oppressors by whatever means they determine. So within China, it took some years to get that anti-colonial movement started. And it was really at the start of the 20th century, the early 1900s, was when we just see generally a more rise in global resistance to colonial rule. And this had a lot to do with the fall of the last dynasty in China, the Qing dynasty. They were completely useless when it came to resisting occupation. Useless monarchy is really not that surprising. That's when it really began. The fall of the empire and of the Qing empire, and people started to see, we need to get these foreign bodies out of here. In 1919, the May 4th movement happened, and that was a response to the Versailles Treaty. You know, this was the end of World War I. And it's kind of bizarre to think about it. So they have this meeting in Versailles, which I think is in France, right? Other part of the world. They made a decision saying, we're going to hand over the German areas to the Japanese in China. And so that pissed people off in China, saying, why are these deals being made somewhere else? So they had a massive protest and fight in there. And a lot of the leaders in that movement became the founders of the Chinese Communist Party, including a guy who actually interpreted the international from Russian to Chinese, Chu Chubai, the guy who was all about exterminating parasites, right? Good guy. So there were many debates within the Chinese Communist Party after its founding in 1921 of how to accomplish the dual tasks of both ridding China of foreign powers and as well as ending capitalist exploitation. I'm not going to go through all those debates. There's a great book that people should check out, the Haymarket Book Room, called The Tragedy of the Chinese Revolution by Harold Isaacs. The Reader's Digest version is that the Russian Revolution was in trouble, you know, that happened just prior to the Chinese establishment of the Communist Party, and the failure of the German Revolution following the Russian Revolution, a success was needed. The Russians, communists, needed an ally, needed some success somewhere. And the dominant voices within the Communist International, which was an organization made up of communists from around the world to try and talk about how to spread the ideas of revolution, to spread revolution in other countries, ultimately, the ideas that went out was we want a get-rich-quick scheme in China. We want to unite with the Kuomintang, which was a nationalist organization. It didn't matter that the Kuomintang was headed up by a murderous gangster named Chiang Kai-shek. And I don't use murderous gangster in a pejorative sense. It's a descriptive sense. He was actually a murderous gangster. And it didn't matter that they wanted them to join. So they basically ordered the Communist Party to become subservient to this Kuomintang. Stalin actually said that the Kuomintang, you know, this party headed by Chiang Kai-shek, would be squeezed out like a lemon and then thrown away. And unfortunately, the opposite happened. It was the Chinese communists, that was the lemon that got squeezed and thrown away. Chinese communists were killed by the tens of thousands by Chiang Kai-shek and his forces, and the Chinese Communist Party, remained of it, fled basically to the countryside. It went from an organization that was leading strikes in major cities along the coast to basically hiding out in the woods and trying to maintain whatever forces they could. So that was a significant change. It was a change from an outlook of an urban, working class centered outlook to one of being led by, you know, organized around the farmers and often in the hinterlands. As comrades have maybe heard, and I'm sure have heard in other sessions, the concept of socialism from below means that workers themselves have to be involved in their own liberation. It cannot happen by any other means. This isn't the Harry Potter world where you just wave a wand and say, oh, you have socialism, go about and live excellently. Like the great socialist said, Eugene Debs, If you are looking for Moses to lead you out of the capitalist wilderness, you will stay right where you are. I would not lead you into the promised land if I could, because someone else could lead you out. You must use your heads as well as your hands to get yourself out of the present situation. And someone else wrote, I think someone similar said, the emancipation of the working class must be the act of the working class. Forget the name, but you get the idea. It's kind of the same idea. Socialism has to come up from below. So in China, because of some really bad advice by those who had taken, who had revolutionary credibility, you know, the Comintern, the Russian leaders of the Russian Revolution, the Communist Party that succeeded in kicking out the Japanese occupation, and then getting rid of Chiang and his buddies, sending him off to Taiwan, and establishing the People's Republic of China in 1949, it was a very different organization than it was in the 1920s. The Chinese working class, as small as it was, you know, comparative to the population, played almost no role in the 1949 revolution. Again, this is no hate for the Communist Party for achieving this goal of national liberation. That's a good thing. We support national liberation. But as materialists, we have to call something what it is and not just what they call themselves. So that's why I would say it's a nationalist revolution. It wasn't a socialist revolution. We're a different mode of production where workers actually democratically ran the economy. So following the 49 revolution, a lot of things happened. I'm not going to talk about them. In short, the goal was to develop the Chinese economy as quickly as possible so people could get fed, borders maintained, and these things were not for the benefit of the Chinese people writ large, but for the people who were running it. Different leaders in China had different methods to try and accomplish this. Deng Xiaoping, who was the leader of China from 1978 to 92, was about bringing the market to develop the economy. In 1984, he made a speech to a Japanese delegation saying, "The fundamental task for the socialist stage is to develop the productive forces. To do this, we have to invigorate the domestic economy and open the outside world." Another way he put it was, "To get rich is glorious." So that's in a nutshell. You can summarize what Deng was about. I mean, the international... Oops. So That was Deng's approach. It entailed a multi-prong of bringing markets of forces into the countryside, where 80% of the population lived and worked, and developing industries in multiple coastal cities through foreign investments, new technology, and Western management techniques. It was clear that this approach has been successful in making China the rising power that it is today. In order to further this economic development, the government also had to educate a homegrown army of technicians, engineers, and managers. This entailed expanding access to education. In 10 years, the number of colleges and universities increased significantly from 400 to 1,000, and the student body numbering over 2 million. In Beijing alone, there were 400,000 students. It's impressive numbers. So besides opening up economic reforms, it was also important to relax the political control that the Communist Party had to some extent. Greater latitude to think and to debate freely was a necessary precondition to economic reforms in China. Market reforms also depended on the freedom of middle and lower level functionaries to think on their own and take initiatives. From the party's point of view, this had to be a controlled opening. It was just in recent memory the Cultural Revolution was happening, which was uncontrolled and later controlled. And so that danger of things going off the rails was certainly in the back of their minds. Educational institutions in particular had to have an increased space for free development of thought, as it's difficult to encourage students to think out of the box and build their confidence to lead China as an up-and-coming world power if every aspect of your life is managed from sunup to sundown. So in order for the ruling class in China to establish credibility, there had to be space for discussion of past mistakes. This also helped expand the social base of the ruling class to win popular consent for further economic restructuring, just basically getting people who are willing to take part in this entire project. Many students and intellectuals were aware of the reforms taking place in neighboring Russia under Gorbachev. The idea of perestroika, which means restructuring, was implemented in Russia in 1985 because of a stagnating economy. Glasnost, which means opening, began in a few years later and allowed for more political reforms. So many Chinese realized, well, we're getting a lot of perestroika, but not much glasnost. And so that was a sore spot for some of them. Economic reforms, while certainly not carried out in the most systematic or effective manner, did lead to 10% growth in the economy almost every year throughout the 1980s. Through this period of growth, the Chinese ruling class fought internally about the direction of the country. There was modernizers on one wing and conservatives on the other. They all agreed China needed to develop, but the debate was about which degree of economic control should they have over society. Would it be better to let the market rip and have the chips fall where they may, or should each step be carefully planned and executed? So regarding political freedoms, there was general agreement that they should grant the minimal freedoms necessary to create incentives for growth. But by granting just even a taste of freedom, it did whet the appetite for much more of that. So the death of a reformer, Hu Yaobang, is what sparked the initial occupation by students of Tiananmen. He was seen as someone who was for the people, who was against corruption. As the protests continued, he became less of a focus because as dissatisfaction with the status quo sharpened. While the movement overall never really crystallized on a specific blueprint for changing China's society, there wasn't like saying this is what we're fighting for very clearly, but it was basically anger against the system, and at the heart of it was an overall struggle for democratic rights. People wanted to have freedom of speech, freedom to assemble, that kind of thing, freedom of the press. So this brings me to my second point. Sorry, that was kind of, the other ones are shorter. To my second point about how the student movement provoked a workers' movement. When the occupation of the square was flagging, so this is after Hu Yaobang's death, there was people occupying the square, the numbers started to dwindle, and so they called a hunger strike. And in a country where mass starvation was within living memory for many people, the hunger strike succeeded at raising the level of sympathy for the students' cause. As in all societies, the youth are seen as the future, and when the students were putting their own lives at risk, it struck a chord with people across the country in a way that previous actions had not. On the fourth day of the strike, 600 students were taken to the hospital. They were so sick from not eating. And hundreds of thousands of residents of Beijing, like regular working people, came out to support the students. I'm going to read a brief report from a book called Tiananmen, The Rape of Peking. And it says, "The following day, the students staged their biggest demonstration yet. After encouragement, more than a million people took to the streets. They did so again on Thursday. Sympathy demonstrations broke out in at least 24 cities across the country." 24 cities across the country. This was not just in Tiananmen, it was spreading to other parts. Along Chang'an Avenue, which is the main street that leads across the one end of Tiananmen, hotel bellboys in dinner jackets turned out alongside Mao-suited cadres from the foreign ministry. The national volleyball team was there, and so was the Christian seminary, marching under the banner, "The Lord loves you, long live democracy." Can't argue with that. Shaven-headed Buddhist monks paraded in yellow robes. School children thrust tiny fists in the air, led by their teachers in chants of "Long live democracy, down with corruption." Workers arrived from Beijing Brewery, the Capital Iron and Steelworks, and the Beijing Jeep Corporation. "Get up and stand up for your rights," was chanted by a group of teenagers carrying a black and white banner with the image of Bob Marley on it. Of all the slogans, of all the placards and the flags in view all around Tiananmen Square that day, the most worrying one for the leadership was the long red banner carried by short-haired men in uniforms, and it read, "The People's Liberation Army." Well, that's a problem. You get this massive protest, and the army is there with the protest. That's not a good sign. So this was basically kind of the apex of the struggle, I would say. It was clear that the bureaucracy had to act if the status quo was going to be maintained, and the army began to be brought into Beijing. Martial law was declared in the days following. And really, there was a heroic standing up by the citizens of Beijing to try and prevent the army from coming into it. They had been constantly outmaneuvered by the people. They basically would sit in these vans. You can see the images from some of the videos out there of people trying to throw cucumbers at them, give them food. Actually, these just fraternization was happening between the citizens of Beijing and these people who are mostly from the farmers from the countryside, you know, the sons of farmers from the countryside who had never been to Beijing before, trying to figure out what the fuck is going on here. And that fraternization was obviously an issue. They were chanting, you know, "Go home, the people of army should love the people, not be here to do anything bad to us." The outpouring of support materialized because ordinary people supported the students against the government. While they may not share the political positions of the students, they're fed up for their own reasons. And when the government ordered the invasion, the people of Beijing knew which side they fell on. The movement's growth highlights the role of the working class in the struggle. The Beijing Autonomous Union was founded only weeks before the crackdown by workers who wanted to do something about inflation and the corruption they saw in the official state-run union, as it was basically a joke union. Wang Hui, a student leader, among the last to leave the square, as the tanks rolled in, explains, "The ones who made the big sacrifice in 89 were not the students or the intellectuals, but the workers and other citizens. The government's big worry was social unrest, and the autonomous trade union was their top target. The union would put posters out talking about what they believed in. One of them read, we have calculated carefully, based upon Marxist capital, the rate of exploitation of workers. We discovered that the servants of the people swallow all the surplus value produced by the people's blood and sweat, and there are only two classes, the rulers and the ruled. The political campaigns of the past 40 years amount to a political method of suppressing the people. History's final accounting has yet to be completed." Again, that's a problem for the government, who calls itself socialist, when the workers themselves are saying, we got some unfinished business to take care of. So there was definitely tensions, though, between the workers' movement and the student movement. This was partly due to workers being alienated from the political process in general, and maybe some snobbery and elitism on the part of some students. But there was a dominant argument within the student movement about keeping the movement pure. Like, we want to keep it for what we started this. We want to be maybe free from the involvement of quote-unquote common people. And this lack of trust by intellectuals does have some historical roots, in the sense of the Cultural Revolution was kind of seen as the insanity that was produced by the working class unleashed upon intellectuals. And so you can kind of see the material base for these ideas. In short, the student rebellion was tolerated, however begrudgingly, by the government. But when the working class began to mobilize, when protests and struggles began to break out in other cities, when fraternization was occurring between soldiers and workers, and let's remember, there's a blurry line between those two things. One of the main leaders of the Beijing Autonomous Workers Federation was Han Dongfang. He was actually a soldier before he was a worker, like we have in this country. And he was a leader of that struggle. He later left and is in Hong Kong and has this great resource called China Labor Bulletin. When these forces came into motion, when the working class began to move, that's when the decision was made by the government to shut it down. So on the night of June 3rd and into the morning of the early hours of June 4th, the square was basically cleared with tanks and guns. And there was definitely bloodshed. So this brings me to my third point. Why is it important that as socialists we kind of understand how to evaluate these situations such as Tiananmen? And there are two main perspectives presented when it comes to kind of looking back at Tiananmen, and both of them are basically wrong. The first point is from a liberal standpoint. The PBS recently produced a documentary about Tiananmen. It's worth watching. It's got amazing footage of the struggle. The politics are kind of milquetoast, you know, like, why did they go so far? And the radicals took the lead. The pronunciation of Chinese is just awful. I don't know why they got it so bad. That's kind of the liberal standpoint, like the goddess of democracy, and that's the kind of stuff they highlight. They definitely don't talk about the Beijing Autonomous Workers. That's not a highlight of the liberal view or the dominant view from here. The second perspective would be from the Chinese state, which correctly viewed this uprising as a threat to their existence, and they politically justify by saying that these are counter-revolutionaries. We have to shut down the counter-revolutionary students and workers. There was an incident where a soldier was lynched because he was shooting at people. You know, that kind of, there was a cause and effect there. But they highlighted that, saying this is why it's counter-revolutionary, this is why we have to shut it down with arms. So the subset of this kind of perspective of the Chinese state are socialist groups who take as a starting point that China is a socialist country and therefore must defend any action that this country takes. In the U.S., the most fervent defender of the massacre is the Party of Liberation Socialism, formerly known as Workers' World. And maybe a little less excited defender would be Freedom Road. This is another group that kind of defends the crackdown in Tiananmen. And before I go on and talk about those organizations, I will say I've worked with many members and continue to work with many members of those organizations. I have no personal ill will against them. I want to continue to work with them. I want to maintain commonly relations. But in the strongest possible terms, I disagree with their assessment of Tiananmen. I'll put it like that. Workers' World was founded in 1959 by members of the Socialist Workers' Party, Trotskyist organization in the U.S. And they, they, it was Sam Macy started because he didn't like the line, the dominant line that the Hungarian uprising in 1956 was right. And so they formed Workers' World on the basis of saying the Russians were correct to send tanks into Budapest and shut down the uprising in Hungary. This is maybe not a well-known thing, a well-known event in 1956 in Hungary. There's a short article that I wrote some years ago in the ISR, if you want to read one view. So anyway, that was the founding of the Workers' World Party. So you can kind of see they like tanks in 56, they like tanks in 1989, so whatever, you know. I only recently learned that there's a pejorative being used against some people called tanky. And while I am generally opposed to name calling as a useful exercise when it comes to genuine political debate, I understand its origin. It was interesting, after a commemoration I wrote on Tiananmen that was published in Jacobin last month, I got a call from my friend Joe Allen, was like, oh, the Facebook page is all excited about your article. And at first I was like, oh yeah, that sounds great. And then I remembered, well, Facebook is kind of fucked up. And then I got on Facebook, and my, you know, suspicions were confirmed. Like half of the posts were people posting and reposting this article written by a leader in the PSL, Brian Becker. The article is titled, Tiananmen, the Massacre That Wasn't. It asserts that the goal of the U.S. government was to carry out regime change in China. You know, basically a foreign body started Tiananmen and overthrow the Communist Party of China. It goes on to say if counter-revolution were to succeed in China, the consequences would be catastrophic for the Chinese people and for China. In the confrontation between world imperialism and the People's Republic, progressive people should know where they stand, and it's not in the sidelines. So the Becker family and I actually have a history. I don't know them. I'm sorry. I'm lying about that. But I did actually write an article about Tiananmen some years ago on the 20th anniversary of a socialist worker, and it really pissed off the brother, Richard Becker. And so he wrote an article denouncing the ISO and me for hostility to the Chinese Revolution. So anyway, that's their position. And at the heart of the debate is really a characterization of the Chinese Revolution and really socialist revolution in general. Like, how do you understand 49? Like, what do we say about that revolution? And I think Hal Draper, a socialist, was right when he wrote his excellent pamphlet, The Two Souls of Socialism, that you can either see socialism coming from above, you know, whether it's like instituted by a Swedish government or from, or a victorious military struggle, it's still from above, or you can see socialism is coming from below, where workers become fit to rule, as Marx put it, because socialism is achieving their own struggles as a class, like Deb said, with their hands and their hearts. Real struggles in the workplaces, neighborhoods, and schools. That's where I think we see socialism as genuinely coming about. And so as socialists, we should be able to have sharp debates. And if anybody in the audience wants to condemn me or call me names, that's, you know, fair enough. I understand. I think we have to have debates about stuff, not just about Tiananmen. Maybe there won't be debate about Tiananmen in this room, but debates in general about politics among socialists is important. We should, if we can't tell each other what we think and disagree with each other, how are we going to take the bosses on? It's just not going to happen. That's why I'm wearing my Be Excellent to Everybody t-shirt today, to just remind me. Sometimes I forget, you know. So anyway, when it comes to the more popular narratives, you know, the capitalist countries versus the socialist countries, there's almost a symmetry to them. I'm talking again, not about the socialist groups, but the governments, their view of Tiananmen. For the Western capitalists, you have the characterization of socialism as gray suits and bread lines, and they point it to it from afar, saying, this is an alternative to capitalism. You may not like capitalism, yeah, there's racism, sexism, there's war, but at least we don't have the bread lines and those gray suits, you know, those really suck. They're probably itchy suits. And at the same time, from the communists, quote-unquote communist countries, they can point at the capitalist countries, say, look at the racism and sexism and war, which is all true, that's worse than your gray suit and your bread line, you know. And so there's almost a symmetry on that, basically saying, both societies are sit upon by the rulers of the society, the people under them continue to work. They continue to park their boats inside bigger boats. They get on the TV and teach us about history and airports and the Revolutionary War. And the rest of us, you know, continue to go to work every damn day and wonder about the bad choices we made, like the choice not to have a rich parent, you know, or whatever. And it's not just here. It's not in the United States. It's also in China. Not being born in wealth is a problem everywhere. Fortunately, history has a different tendency, has demonstrated a different tendency. The people in itchy gray suits have risen up. They rose up in Hungary in 1956, in Czechoslovakia in 68, in Poland in 1980, in China in 89. They've risen up in many other countries, not just the former satellite of Russia. Portugal in 74, Chile in 72, France in 68, Iran in 79. There's a rich history of working class fight back around the world. And we don't learn that when we turn on the television and watch Fox News, or even NBC, MSNBC, or PBS. We're not going to learn that history. We have to go to the Haymarket Book Room or find our comrades and find our resources and teach ourselves the history of working class fight back, working class struggle. And those ideas are not taught widely because they're dangerous. They're dangerous to the people who run the Chinese government. They're dangerous to the people who run this government. And that's why we have to pick that up. So the final point I'm going to make is about the dynamics which produce Tiananmen. They have not been resolved. These contradictions that produce struggle have produced struggle since Tiananmen, and they will continue to produce struggle moving forward as we see what's happening in Hong Kong over these past couple of weeks. I've spent a lot of time discussing the method of evaluation of these struggles, of becoming confused by nomenclature, by saying, well, the Chinese government is socialist, so you know, doesn't that mean that they're right? But we have to look deeper. We have to understand the underlying class and social dynamics at work to understand what we want to do. As our friend Karl Marx quipped once, philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it. We're not having an abstract conversation about Tiananmen just to understand, you know, an interesting history. We can debate Tiananmen, we can debate 49, we can debate the Cultural Revolution, but the positions one takes on those things will actually determine what we do. But that's the most important thing, is what do we need to do? What kind of action do we need to take? The rise of China, from Tiananmen onwards, has disturbed those who run our society here. And there's a whole session on that in this room after lunch. Ashley and some of our other comrades are going to be speaking about the current situation in China and imperialism. So people should definitely come back and be part of that, be part of the conversation. But I think when most people think about China, they don't think about gray suits and bread lines anymore. They think about iPhones and trade wars. That's kind of the most common thing that comes to mind. The China today is definitely not the China of 1989. I had an opportunity. I lived in China when I was a child. My dad got a job teaching English there, and it was an eye-opening experience for me to be there in 1988. I remember coming back into San Francisco Airport and seeing carpet on the walls. And I was like, what the fuck is carpet doing on the walls? Like, I don't remember. There's not even carpets on the floors anywhere in China. Why is this carpet on the walls? And I remember also showing my math teacher in China. It was a first grade math teacher. Showed him a sixth grade math book. And they're like, this is what we do in third grade. Why is this country that dominates the world teaching their kids at such a low level? It was kind of astounding to them. They didn't get it. They didn't understand how this... how such a country that was so low in its education would be so successful. But in China now is totally different. It is different because they put a lot of effort into changing their country. There's 12,000 miles of high-speed railroad in major cities in China right now. These trains travel like 186 miles an hour. You can go from Beijing to Guangzhou in 8 hours. This is the people who don't know, the equivalent distance would be like from New York to Miami, which is like a 19-hour drive if you don't stop for gas and wear a diaper. So it's, you know, it's pretty far. If you take Amtrak from New York to Miami, 28 hours. So bring a book, maybe bring 3 books probably. It's gonna be a little bit. But you know, there's no way. So basically in 28 hours, you could go from Beijing to Guangzhou, back to Beijing, back to Guangzhou, and have 4 hours to get some noodles. You know, it's just ridiculous. While the train from Hong Kong or from New York to Miami is still making its way, and it's actually cheaper. It's not only 20 hours less; it's $20 less to ride between Beijing and Guangzhou than it is to pay for an Amtrak ticket. It's bizarre. So anyway, China is definitely different than 1989, but the underlying dynamic in China is the same. Chinese capitalism produces bullet trains, but it also produces struggle, and a lot of it. There was a strike wave in China lasting several years just recently in the middle of this current decade. There are currently self-described Marxist students organizing solidarity with workers who are being arrested by the government. Tiananmen certainly produced reforms, if not immediately, but not the kind of reforms that workers were demanding. Opportunities now exist that didn't before. That's certainly true. And it's reflected in the ridiculous rise in the number of billionaires in China. In 1999, there was one billionaire in China. There were 14 in 2006, and now there are 338 billionaires in China. It's pretty amazing. Jack Ma, who's the richest person in China, he's the founder of Alibaba, it's basically the equivalent of Amazon here, is worth $39 billion. And of course, he's a member of the Chinese Communist Party. Hard-carrying member. You know, solidarity, brother. The China's 1% owns 33% of the wealth. In the U.S., 1% owns about 40%, so yeah, USA, we're still number one. But the political stability in China is a function of China's economic stability, meaning that as long as there's been growth in the economy and people feel like their children will have a better life than they will, it has not allowed the struggles to move beyond some of the locals. Because the strikes that happened in China are very immediate. It's not done by unions. It's people are pissed off, they didn't get paid, so we're not going to work. And then till we get paid. And that's kind of the end of it. Then they go back to repeat, you know. So anyway, it's going to be ongoing. The contradictions has changed. Much like the inflation of that pushed Chinese students and workers to Tiananmen, the future economy in China will definitely impact struggle and produce more struggle. So our job here in the belly of the racist orange beast will be to be in solidarity with the struggles of the people of China, to counter the nationalistic garbage, the rows of American flags that a lot of politicians, including our friend Bernie Sanders, like to stand in front of sometimes, and stand against the idea that just because we all live in the same shithole country doesn't mean we have all the same interests. My interest is not the same as Donald Trump's interest. That's not kind of controversial to say. But just it is a common idea that we're all Americans, so we have to stand up against the Mexicans. We have to stand up against the Chinese. And I'll just end by saying a quote. Sarah Nelson, people may know her. She's a leader of the Association of Flight Attendants. She helped stop the Trump's government shutdown. Some of us went to a rally that the DSA had organized for Eugene Debs, and she told the crowd, our lives and our well-being are completely tied together with the workers of Mexico and Canada, China and Germany. And that's right, that's the future that socialists and workers need to look for, is solidarity across borders. Thank you.